your host, Lonnie Clark. We stand together and accept that we now live in a world transformed by Fukushima. Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time here on UCY.TV Radio. We relentlessly engage every ear that listens. We expose and confront the complete lack of accountability for the nuclear industry. Consider social engineering programs who view our bodies, minds, and souls as assets on a balance sheet. We discuss vital current issues, interview activists, and engage our audience in an effort to allow all voices to be heard. The Age of Vision radio show creates a venue that all will change. We encourage our listeners to reclaim their power and their courage to take action and save our planet from the ravages of greed and indifference. Our actions matter. Every voice matters. We remind our listeners that happiness is resistance. Love is greater than fear.
Good morning, UCY.TV radio listeners. Thank you for joining us today. It is January 22nd, 2018. It's 8 o'clock in the morning here on the West Coast in Eugene, and it is, as usual, gray outside. But I want to thank you for joining us, and I want to thank KEPW.org in Eugene, Oregon, an FM radio station that carries our show. We really appreciate that, and do remember to tell your friends and family. You can only find our radio station online. You can go to TuneIn Radio, I guess. They will have it. So thanks for joining us. Today we have back with us Mr. Guy McPherson, who is really, he has his own website that I highly recommend everybody going to. And is, you just type in GuyMcPherson.com, and it's basically the title of his page is Nature Bats Last, I guess. That's the name of it. So thanks, Guy, for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me back on, Lonnie. I appreciate it as well.
Yeah. Well, to give, for those listeners who didn't hear you before, you're, I guess, what's known as the doom and happy face guy, the man who's out there telling people that we need to really brace ourselves for some dramatic changes to our environment that are going to cause most of humanity to die rapidly. Does that sum it up in one little tiny bit?
Yeah, that's just about perfect, in fact. And it's, you know, especially when I talk to people in the, quote, first world, they seem surprised when I remind them they're going to die and that all species go extinct. But most of us came to grips with that, or at least accepted the fact that we, as individuals, were going to die when we were, you know, 11 or 12 years old. So I'm just reminding that living with urgency is not necessarily a bad approach. And it's an approach practiced by many, many of the Eastern religions, for example. And I don't think there's any harm in living with urgency, in living with death in mind.
Well, I kind of agree with you on that one. I think that, in fact, we ought to live with urgency because, I mean, let's just say the best case scenario that we have 300 years left. 300 is still not very many years. You know what I mean? Like, before I heard you, I was following that. What really woke me up environmentally was the Fukushima event, frankly, as you can tell by the name of my show. But I was thinking we had 300 to 500 years to really figure this thing out. And then I saw a documentary called The Arctic Death Spiral and what's it called? The Methane Time Bomb, The Arctic Death Spiral and the Methane Time Bomb. And it was really explaining how the methane is seriously escaping from our atmosphere at unprecedented rates. And the planet's atmosphere is dramatically changing at a rate faster than anybody could even believe 50 years ago. This is like shocking. It was all these scientists. So then I started to think, then I started to think we don't have 50 years, right? Or 500 years. I started thinking in terms of 200 or 300. But what's your suggestion? Like, how much longer do we really have before? And what are going to be the telltale signs of when it starts to really, not that we don't see them already, but like people still in America still have their basic normal, quote, normal life.
Right. To the extent that's normal, although it's historically unbelievably abnormal the way people in the quote first world are living today. So it is unusual, and we have come to accept it as normal through the process known as normalcy bias. It would stun me. I would be shocked, amazed, and thrilled if there was a human being on the planet in 2026. And
2026? You're talking 10 years, less than 10 years from now?
Yeah, if I'm doing the math right, that's 8 years from now.
Yeah.
And that's because of an event called abrupt climate change, which is taking us at or near the highest temperature observed on planet Earth, which is 252.2 million years ago during the Great Dying. We're headed that way in 8 years. So I don't, since more than 95% of the species on the planet went extinct during the Great Dying 252.2 million years ago, because of that rapid rise in temperature, and because this time the rise in temperature is occurring 10 times faster than it did that time, I just don't see much potential for complex multicellular life to persist into the medium or distant future.
Wow.
By that long, oh, I thought maybe you'd keel over. Sorry. And of course, most people will die before then. You know, it's not as if I say we have 8 years and then come midnight that day, 8 years from now, everybody keels over dead. No, more likely we will experience an ice-free Arctic this year as projected by a paper published in 2012 in the Annual Review of Earth and Planetary Sciences. There they concluded 2016, plus or minus 3 years, we would experience an ice-free Arctic Ocean. And we haven't had an ice-free Arctic Ocean for more than 3 million years.
Wow.
Certainly considerably longer than we've had humans on the planet. The president of Finland said in a joint press conference with President Trump on August 28th, 2017, quote, if we lose the Arctic, we lose the planet. That's reality, end quote. And what he meant was if we lose the ice in the Arctic Ocean for the first time in human history, then we also lose habitat for human animals here on planet Earth. And shortly after we lose habitat for us or any other organism on the planet, we lose the ability to support that species, which means us. And so we're going to lose habitat for our favorite species, and then we will lose every last individual member of our favorite species. And, you know, this is not something that I want to happen by any stretch of the imagination, but having studied conservation biology for a long time and recognizing the importance of habitat and how extinction tends to play out, I don't see that we are so much more special than every other species on the planet that's gone extinct, including half a dozen species of the genus Homo. Homo sapiens, the extinction of Homo sapiens should come as no surprise, given that a handful of other species in the genus Homo have gone extinct as well. So it's not like this should be a surprise to anybody, except that our lives do seem so normal compared to what we were born into. We were all born into this set of living arrangements, and it keeps going as if there can be no adverse consequences. But there are. You know, we're fouling the air and dirtying the water and driving to extinction 200 species every day. So, of course, at some point, we run out of habitat for our own species. But we don't see it, largely because we don't want to see it, and also because we have bought into normalcy bias and television advertising, and it all looks good and rosy. You know, we got smartphones. What could possibly go wrong?
Yeah, well, wait till the 5G comes up. That's when things are really going to go wrong. That's going to be a very harmful thing. I mean, I think that's going to be it on steroids. But, you know, that idea about the Arctic melting, I recently saw a video clip of, it's called The Frozen Forests, and it talks about the forests in the Arctic. They're frozen most of the time, but they have a very small window, a very short window, like maybe I think it's at a month or a month and a half of green in spring when it was the least cold, but it actually produced more than half of the world's oxygen. And when that melts, that is where we're going to, that's where it's going to go. And that combined with that video that I was talking about, the Arctic death spiral, the scientists, and I think they, the group of scientists you alluded to were in that video clip, because this is just a movie, it's just a documentary of all these different various groups of scientists bringing their message. It was all the same thing. They all basically said the same thing, that we're really seriously going to have a methane time bomb. There's something like 800 gigatons of methane that's starting to escape off the Russian coast. That's where all those big explosions are coming up from the earth and things. But they were talking about how once that happens, there's like no going back. It's going to go way, way, way faster.
Yeah, and there's already no going back. We're in the midst of abrupt, irreversible climate change. And so that it's going to get worse should come as no surprise, because we aren't doing anything differently. We aren't, you know, every year we emit more carbon dioxide than we did the year before. And now we have indeed triggered methane release as well. Methane is 100 times more powerful a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, molecule for molecule. So a little bit of methane goes a really long way towards heating the planet, initially locally and then regionally and then within a year about planetary wide. So, you know, we've triggered these self-reinforcing feedback loops, these so-called positive feedbacks, and some of them amplify very, very quickly, including methane in the atmosphere. So we have, it's not the, just that we are headed for the edge of the cliff. We've gone over the cliff. We just haven't looked down yet, most of us. And so we don't know that we're in the Wile E. Coyote moment, still spinning our legs, but we haven't looked down to discover that the drop is underway, and it's not going to be pleasant when we land.
Yeah, I used to say that we've been pushed over Niagara Falls in a barrel, and we just haven't hit the bottom yet, because it's kind of what it feels like. It's this big adventure. Everyone thinks that we're on this big adventure, this big scientific adventure, right? So no matter what side you're on, like with the people that, you know, with the geoengineering and all the chemtrails that are up there, all, you know, there's a whole circus of people who basically deny that that's even happening. And it's kind of like this whole thing of, what do you believe in?
Your example of the Niagara Falls in the barrel is an excellent example. It's not the fall that kills you. It's the abrupt stop at the bottom.
Right, exactly. And that's right.
So we're all in the barrel, as it were, and we've gone over the cliff, and it seems fine. It's an adventure, like that's life right. is supposed to be. And most people lose track of the fact that life is, in fact, an adventure. And so they're failing to seize the moments that occur along the adventurous path. And that's one of the messages that I'm trying to relay here, is that life is an adventure. Life can be filled with joy and filled with memorable, adventurous moments if we allow it, instead of getting trapped by the dominant paradigm that tells us we need to go to school and go to school some more and get married and have 2.5 children and blah, 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 and work and work and work and work until we retire at the age of 65. And then and only then are we allowed to have fun. Then and only then, if we're financially stable and too old to get out of bed most mornings, are we willing to let ourselves experience joy and do the things we've always wanted to do. Let's do those now. You know, there's a great sign I came across a few months ago in the Billy City Airport, of all places, for a tourist company. Bad advertising, because I don't remember which one. But the sign says, there are 7 days in the week. Someday is not one of them. And yet we all act as if someday we're going to do this, someday we're going to do that. Let's make it today. Let's actually start doing those things we say that we're going to do someday, when we're able, when we're ready, when the kids are out of school, when blah, blah, blah. Right? So let's do those things now.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a big issue, but I think one of the hardest issues is for people to decide what it is they want to do. Like, what are your dreams? I think people have just sort of been overworked and battered into not even understanding that they have a right to dream and think of things that they want to do and get out of the cycle. You know,
I think that's right, because we're all born into a set of living arrangements, born into captivity, as my friend Tim Bennett likes to say.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't know that there's another option.
Mm-hmm.
At the Stardust Sanctuary, where I live now, my partner Pauline has Workaway guests, workaway.info, and there are three of them right here at the table with me right now. Oh, four, and they're great. They're mostly young people in their 20s, sometimes in their 30s, and they have chosen an alternative route. They have chosen to not jump on the treadmill, stay on the treadmill, go to school, get married, have 2.5 children. They're living as if time is short. So they're doing the things, they're acting as if someday is today. And they're wonderful. They're just a breath of fresh air, much as I hate to say that with them in my presence, because, you know, they might seem pretty important.
Yeah.
But they're just a lot of fun. There are people who have stepped off the treadmill that is the dominant narrative and are living fully every day and doing different things than they're told to do or they're assumed to do by the dominant paradigm, which I think is just wonderful.
Mm-hmm. I do too. And I think that it's important for us, especially when the time is short. I mean, I find the most difficult part about how it's kind of like we have this knowledge or an acceptance of this knowledge. And most people feel threatened even talking about it. Like, with my children and my family, I have grown children that are 36 and 33, and their eyes kind of roll and like, well, you know, what are we going to do? And so they think that I should not be focusing on this, that this is, you know, something that's just sort of a pointless exercise. I think it's very important for people to understand that time is short, that we really don't have the answers. This is when I started to turn around after listening to you, because like I said before, when I first heard you speak, I was super angry. Like, who are you to tell us we're going to die in 50 years? And I think you've evolved. You've actually shortened that number. The 5 years I've been hearing you. Right?
The evidence gets worse every day. It's not
yes.
as if there's a bunch of evidence. Climate scientists saying we have more and more times the situation is getting better somehow. Every single week, there's more evidence that time is shorter than we thought. And, you know, I can think of two excellent personal examples of the time being short. The Buddha said, the trouble is, you think there's time. And then a couple thousand years later, the world's oldest human being at the time, in early March of 2015, at her 117th birthday party, was asked what she thought about those first 117 years of her life. And she said, it seemed rather short. 117 years old. Well, I promise that essentially nobody listening to this show is going to live to the age of 117. That's unbelievably rare for somebody to live that long. And she said, it seemed rather short. So, of course, our time on this planet is short. We don't have long. And so let's live with that in mind, with the notion that, in fact, we don't have long, because we don't.
Let me ask you this. Do you think that it is worthwhile for people to engage in looking for solutions, you know, attempting to change the political scene? I mean, people pick their poisons, right? They decide what they're going to get engaged in. Do you think that that's worthwhile? Like, is it just like, should we just figure out a way to do self-defense and live day to day? Or is it worthwhile to get engaged, say, to make our society better and, you know, of what we've got left?
Of course, it's always better to try to make the situation better. It's always a good idea to act as if time is short, to act with urgency and try to fix things, make them better now. If it weren't for people attempting to improve a dire situation, we wouldn't have had Rachel Carson writing Silent Spring, we wouldn't have passed the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act and the National Environmental Policy Act and the Endangered Species Act. So I'm not suggesting that people just roll over and die. Not at all. I'm suggesting that people act in ways that will improve the situation for humans and other organisms on the planet, not to capitulate to the notion that we're all going to die and that's going to happen tomorrow or next week. Not at all. We're here. Let's act as if humans and other organisms matter. Let's take the actions that demonstrate that we believe that they matter. And if we die tomorrow, if we die next week, at least at the end of the day, we can look ourselves in the mirror and say, I think we did the right thing. So I'm not suggesting that we all start living as hedonists, although for the most part, I'd have a hard time telling a difference with the American lifestyle and what most people call hedonism. I'm suggesting that we take right action from a Buddhist perspective and not be attached to the outcome, because I think no matter how we stack it, the outcome looks really dire for us as individuals, for us as a species. But to quote Monty Python, I'm not dead yet. You know, so none of us are dead yet. How are we going to go out? How are we going to act? If we are the last individuals of our species, and I suspect those of us on the planet today are the last individuals of our species, how are we going to act? What kind of example are we going to set? How do we want to see the movie end? With us partying like it's 1999 or acting with integrity? I'd prefer the latter myself. And that gives me the opportunity, if nothing else, to look myself in the mirror at the end of the day without embarrassment. And I think that's enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that is enough. It's like that little meme that I saw that said, stop acting like you live twice, right? So we have one life, and I think it is worthwhile to make, I mean, it does look grim. I mean, the fact is, if you look at all the factors, but it is not, it's what we've chosen. We came here, our spirits chose this time. So there's, I believe that we picked this time to live in. So there must be a reason why we're here. And I don't know what the long-term picture is, but acting as if we're going to live forever and, you know, working towards that end, no matter how much of a short time it appears that we have, because life is just not guaranteed anyways. I mean, who's to say when you're going to die?
No, Homer wrote the Iliad more than 2,500 years ago. And in it, he says that any moment may be our last, of course. And he writes that you will never be more beautiful than you are today, that we will never experience this moment again. So more than 2,500 years ago, Homer was pointing out that short, just as the Buddha was doing more than 2,500 years ago, just as Rachel Carson was doing some 50 years ago. And so on. The list goes on of people who have pointed out that living with urgency and taking actions to try to improve the situation, those are better ways to go. Even if we're not successful, even if our actions don't turn towards a positive outcome, so what? We aren't in control of everything. We're barely in control of anything.
Exactly.
So given that, let's still take the actions that might improve the situation, because what's the alternative? The alternative is take actions that will make matters worse. Who wants to have that on their shoulders?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then that really is the issue. Now, do you suggest that, you know, that people give up their lifestyles and, you know, throw care to the wind and start, you know, doing what they wanted? I mean, this is the thing when you say act with urgency. I mean, most people are entrenched in mortgages and kids and lifestyle and school and the whole thing. It's hard to extricate yourself from all of that lifestyle.
You know, of course, and I'm not suggesting that at all. I'm not suggesting that people forego their responsibility as parents, as spouses, as partners, as coworkers, as colleagues. I'm not suggesting that at all. But there's a line here between hedonism and taking an extra 5 hours off from work to spend with your children every week.
Mm-hmm.
So we can all throughout the day and throughout the week, we can all take actions that will, if not improve the situation for those around us, at least not make them worse. And I suspect that working 80 hours a week for your favorite corporation is not going to be something that when you're on your deathbed, you'll be proud of. I don't think anybody dies with this thought in mind. I should have bought more crap. I don't think anybody dies with the notion of I should have gone to work more. So, yes, almost all of us are trapped within the monetary system, as I am, as everybody I know is. We are bound to the system, which arose only a few thousand years ago, and now seems to control every aspect of our lives. But that doesn't mean that we can't take a weekend off, for crying out loud. That doesn't mean we can't spend the evenings with our loved ones and our children. That doesn't mean we have to work all the time, every day, as I did for most of my adult life. I considered it a badge of honor when I was working 80 hours a week. Now I look back and I realize that I wasn't living, I was working. I was living to work instead of working to live. And most of us can get by on 40 or 50 hours a week, and that leaves plenty of time to experience joy with the people around us.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's such a bad way to go.
Yeah, it's actually a healthier way to go, and it does actually prove out. I mean, that whole thing of it, when you say it's like a badge of honor, a few years ago, I was sort of in that cycle, 5 or 6 years ago, where I was just working so many hours, and I had no life to live. There was no part, no space for me or my children or anything. So, but I think most people come to that conclusion. But this idea that we're living in an environment, I mean, most of us wake up every day in most parts of the country to the chemicals being sprayed above our heads. You know, I know here in Eugene, that's what happens. We, even like on today, a gray day, we'll still see the clouds forming. You know, they'll be still spraying us. We are cognizant of the fact that we're still getting high levels of radioactivity spewing over from Fukushima. I mean, on a subtle level, you can push these things back. We see people in the streets, the homeless people in the streets. I mean, these are all signs that the civilization is collapsing around us. And yet we're allowed, you know, we can go sort of push it out of our heads. And I think that's why having this conversation, at least for myself, is almost like a form of healing, just being able to acknowledge that things have spun out of control. That it's important. Like, you're going to be having a workshop on your website. When people go to your website, guymcpherson.com, and look under events, you're going to have a workshop in Belize, a 90-minute session on March 16th, 2018. And the only love remains. And when people go do this, it's for a nominal fee. I can't believe how inexpensive it is. But when people go down there, what types of, when you say written exercises, what does that mean, written exercises? What do you bring people through at these experiences?
Well, first we start, the goal of the workshop is to have the conversation that most people are unwilling to have and to come to grips with the short nature of your life and to try to complete relationships within your life. And by that, we mean not just with other human beings, although most people are not doing that very effectively. This is a minor example, but one of them that we talk about and we give people the tools to deal with in the workshop. You have relationships that are incomplete. If somebody dies or you separate due to some other means, work, divorce, whatever, then that relationship is frequently incomplete. It ended abruptly, and you never had a chance to say goodbye. You never had a chance to say, mm-hmm. I love you in a meaningful way. You never. So that relationship is just hanging out there, and that's a source of grief. We want to get over that. We don't want people to experience grief for the next several months, years, decades, whatever, when, in fact, there are exercises that will allow you to complete that relationship. And then let's extend that to the living planet, because we've all done things that we're not too proud of. with respect to the living planet, with respect to the way we have conducted our lives with the garbage we threw out in the interstate, with the, you know, a million little examples. So we have these exercises that allow people to contemplate who they are, how they want to behave, how they want to act in their final days, weeks, months. I don't know your expiration date. And yet I know that time is very short for all of us. So how are you going to act if it is, in fact, a movie that we get to see the end of? And most people throughout human history, through the 300,000-year run of our species, most people didn't get to see the end. We get to see the end. How are you going to act at the end? How are you going to treat the living planet? How are you going to treat yourself? How are you going to treat the people around you in our final days? And as Homer said more than 2,500 years ago, any moment may be your last. So these exercises and the full day of introspective contemplation we provide for people to complete the exercises are very important, and they allow people to step off of that treadmill that most of us were born onto and actually think about what it means to be me, what it means to be a human being, what it means to be a human being at the end of the run for human beings, what it means to have a short life, how am I going to conduct that life, what does my life mean to the people around me? So those are the questions we bring up and that we ask people to answer by taking some time, taking hours, in fact, to complete written exercises within some context. And that context is what we provide, the specific questions and issues that we ask people to address. And then we provide time for them to address them. And then we come back together on the third day of the workshop. So the next version of the workshop is scheduled for March 16th through 18th. So we get together for 6.5 or 7 hours on that final day as a group, as a workshop group, as a team. And we talk with each other about what we just went through. And I think this is a wonderful testimony to the workshop. We've never had a workshop where everybody involved didn't cry. And we've never had a workshop where people didn't come very close to each other by the time the workshop was over.
How many of the workshops have you done?
It must be close to a dozen at this point. Going back 4 years or so, and almost all of them in the United States, coast to coast. And one time last year, we held the workshop here in Belize, where we live. And we're doing that again this next round in March. So we've been through this a few times now, and we're starting to get it figured out. And the people leave happy, jovial. They've come to grips with how they're going to live. They don't know their expiration date, but they suspect it's shorter than most people think it is. And so they have taken the time to think, to really think about what it means to be Bob in my remaining days. What do I want on my tombstone? Do I want unequivocal jerk on my tombstone, or do I want my tombstone to say father, brother, friend? So these are the kinds of questions that we bring up that most people in this culture just don't think about. They don't think about how they want to be remembered, and so they don't have a guide for how to conduct their lives. These are the most important things we could possibly think about, and they never come up in the public education system. They never come up anywhere in our lives. Instead, we're jumping on that treadmill, we're making the money, we're spending the money, we're pursuing, quote, happiness in a mostly superficial manner. And I think it's tragic. I think it's just tragic. And so this workshop provides an opportunity to recognize what they're doing, who they are, and what they want to be, who they want to be, and what appears to be our final days. I don't think you could do a lot worse than that, actually.
Mm-hmm. It makes me want to go to Belize, to be honest. It makes me want to figure out. But you are going to be coming here to the States sooner than later. One of the events you'll be doing here is at the Justinson Ranch at SOAP 2018 here in Oregon. Are you going to be conducting a workshop there? Is that part of what you'll do there? Or just speaking?
No, we we offer the workshop anywhere people will have us in exchange for travel expenses and the relatively modest fee associated with the workshop. But it's difficult. It's difficult for people to put together the people and the facilities to run the workshop, to actually conduct the workshop, to host us. So we don't have one planned for late May in Western Oregon. We'd love to, but, you know, we depend upon the kindness of strangers and their ability to put together venues to make that happen.
So your speaking engagements and everything that you've been doing since you embarked on this path has all been crowdfunding?
Yes, and what that means is the crowd almost always falls short of what it actually costs to. And this, despite the fact that I stay in the homes of my hosts and eat at the tables. So it's still expensive. You know, it's expensive for me to get from here to there. So what that means is my loving partners, my ex-wife and now my partner here in Belize, are spending a lot of their money too, because they're committed to getting the message out. But other than that, I depend upon the kindness of strangers who are interested in having the conversation and hearing the information that nobody wants to hear, including me. And so sometimes it works better than others, but I've managed to keep promulgating this message for years now through crowdfunding and through voluntary assistance. Mm-hmm. And I'll keep doing this until I'm no longer able.
I know that I started hearing you, I think it was around 2013. That's when I first heard you speak. You have evolved, right? Your time frame has gotten shorter, because I do recall when I first heard you speak, you were saying no more than 50 years. Now you're saying not really even a decade longer. What have you, was that just me hearing it? But it seems to me like you've sort of progressed in your prognosis.
Well, yeah, two things happened. Time went by, and so we got closer to the edge with every passing month. You know, there's that old expression, if you keep going the direction you're headed, you're going to end up there. And that's what we've been doing. We've been headed for the abyss for a long time without slowing down, without taking a turn. And so, of course, we're still headed that direction. And the other thing is the evidence continues to accumulate. For a long time, I was holding steady at by human extinction by 2050, and then it was by 2030, and then the evidence continued to pile in, and now I say it's by 2026. And I mean by 2026. It's not as if, you know, 7.5 billion people are going to be alive in 2025, and then at midnight on December 31st, everybody dies. No, it's not going to be that way at all. Your time, for those of us who are not putting canned peaches into bunkers, our time is going to be shorter than that. It's not as if we're going to get to December 31st, 2025, at midnight, and then everybody dies.
Now, are you considering a nuclear war? What happened?
I'm not taking that into account. And there's, you know, these are truly desperate times. And so it could very well be that the people pulling the strings of empire recognize, they know what I know because my work is publicly freely available. So it could be they're saying, well, if we're going down in flames anyway in such a short period of time, let's do a nuclear war, just because that might put particulates into the atmosphere, which act as an umbrella and reflect incoming sunlight. That might give us another few years. Yeah, but of course, that's utter catastrophe too. When you're invoking nuclear war to extend our run as a species, I don't see that as a particularly good thing. This is like using chemo and radiation to extend your life in stage 4 cancer.
Right. You're not really, nuclear does not mean extending anything of life. It's nuclear is just all death. Well, I mean, so when you're saying I'm trying to wrap my brain around this really short time frame here that you've got going on, less than 10 years, 8 years. In 5 years, what do you project that this people begin to get some kind of a sense of reality that, hey, we're really on a short leash here?
I suspect most people listening to this interview don't have 2 years, much less five, because we're headed for an ice-free Arctic in the very near future. You remember the analysis conducted by the very conservative, or published in the very conservative journal literature, the Annual Review of Earth and Planetary Sciences. Three of the four authors on that piece were affiliated with the U.S. Naval Postgraduate College. So these are very conservative writers writing for a very conservative outlet. And in 2012, they project an ice-free Arctic in 2016, plus or minus 3 years. And I remember the first media outlet I saw this reported in, I think it was a Christian Science Monitor, and the headline was something like ice-free Arctic in 2016. They failed to mention the plus or minus 3 years part. And then the subhead was 84 years ahead of schedule, as if nature has some sort of schedule, and we just figured it out, and everything happens in 2100. Most climate scientists use that 2100 date as if it's some sort of magical moment. But there is no reason to expect you or I, or most people listening to this radio show, listening to this, there's no reason to expect that we're going to be alive in 5 years. I think that's just fantasy thinking. I think it's really wishful thinking to imagine that most people listening to this are going to survive through an ice-free Arctic, an event that hasn't.
What does that mean when the Arctic goes ice-free? What will happen? What is going to happen when the Arctic goes completely ice, like this summer? Let's say it happens this summer. The years they finally get their digs into ANWR, the ice-free. What will happen?
Right. So immediately we lose the albedo effect. Instead of having white ice in the Arctic reflecting sunlight back into space in the summertime, we have a blue ocean. And that blue ocean is going to absorb the heat. There's something called latent heat. Take a glass full of ice, and then it's not really full, so add water until it's completely full, but not overflowing. And you can walk around for 2 hours, probably, and the water in that glass is at 0 degrees Celsius, 32 degrees Fahrenheit. It's freezing because it's got ice there. And as long as it has a little sliver of ice, it's going to be 0 degrees Celsius, 32 degrees Fahrenheit, or within a half a degree or so of that temperature. So you got a couple hours. You're walking around this glass of ice, or it's sitting on the table or whatever. Well, as soon as that last sliver of ice disappears, the heating increases exponentially. Now, for every calorie added to a gram of ice, so it takes 79.2 calories added to a gram of ice to melt it into a milliliter of water. Now, once you have water instead of ice, that 79.2 calories heats that milliliter of water up to 79.2 degrees Celsius. That is scalding hot. If you step into a shower at 80 degrees Celsius, you're going to step out very quickly, unless you're a lot tougher than me. So what this means is, when we lose the ice in the Arctic, we lose the ability to have ice cubes in our glass at dinner. And so almost immediately, the liquid in our glass heats up to room temperature. Not only that, but we're going to see the methane spew out even faster than it's already doing. We're going to almost certainly experience the first 50 gigaton burst of methane. Natalia Shikova and her colleagues, field researchers,
was in that
warned
movie.
About it. Yeah, of course she was.
She was in tears. She was in tears. She literally was crying in the movie. They asked her what her research meant. Her eyes welled up. She's like, it's not good.
Right. And there in the background was her partner in research and life, Igor Samelatov. And he wouldn't go on camera. Because he knows what it means to promulgate this message. You get disparaged, you get insulted, you have a life that professionally goes to hell because people like Gavin Schmidt, leading climate scientist in the U.S. government, and many others start attacking you for presenting reality. These are field researchers who've been going to the Arctic for two decades, consider another person who was in that documentary film, Peter Wadhams, who mm-hmm. was for many years mm-hmm. the director of the ocean physics program at Cambridge University.
Right.
Well, so and he's conducted more than 50 expeditions on or beneath the Arctic ice. These are the people who know what's actually going on out there, and they know it's horrible. It's dire. They know as soon as we lose the ice in the Arctic, it's game over for habitat for humans on planet Earth. And nobody's happy about this, but at least these people are willing to put themselves out there and promulgate the evidence that they have accumulated. Not very many people are willing to do that because you lose support in your job. You lose your friends. Nobody wants to talk about individuals dying, much less our entire species going extinct. Nobody wants to have that conversation. So for these individuals to put themselves out there professionally and to point out what the evidence is saying, I think is remarkable. Mm-hmm. I have great respect for those few people who are willing to look at the scientific data without flinching and then present it to other people. I think that's remarkable. I think it's wonderful. And I have great respect for that because that's what I've been doing for many years, and I know the cost that it brings.
Mm-hmm. It does bring a cost. So when that 50 gigatons, you said when we have no ice in the Arctic, there's a 50 gigaton escape. I mean, there's 800 gigatons, right, that's down there they know is going to escape. I think that was the number in the documentary.
Right, so I think the 50 gigaton burst that
what will happen?
I think the 50 gigaton burst they wrote about and talked about at the European Geophysical Union meeting in 2008, almost 10 years ago. I think that's a conservative estimate of the burst of methane. What will that do? Almost immediately, it will warm the northern hemisphere by at least 1 degree Celsius.
Wow.
Well, we're at least 1.6 degrees Celsius above the 1750 baseline right now. And 1 degree, according to the United Nations Advisory Group on Greenhouse Gases in October of 1990, 1 degree is the absolute upper limit we can't cross or we trigger these self-reinforcing feedback loops. Well, we're there. We've triggered more than 70 of them. And we get that burst of methane. That's enough to destroy the ability to grow grains in the northern hemisphere, which is where essentially all the grains are grown. So civilization goes away almost immediately. Now we're talking about a nearly 6 degrees Celsius global average temperature rise by, say, summer of 2019. I don't see anybody surviving that who is not living in a bunker surrounded by canned peaches and like-minded sociopaths. I don't want to go out that way, personally. I don't want to live in a bunker. I want to live on Earth. And when we lose the living planet, I'm perfectly happy if there's not a tree on the planet to go. To go just like all the trees did, just like all previous species of our genus.
Well, how will people die in such a quick time? How will people be dying if it's that through starvation or lack of water?
Yeah, those are almost undoubtedly going to be the leading causes of human mortality. First of all, if civilization collapses and does so quickly, as would result, for example, from a big burst of methane that would cause the loss of grain production or the near loss of grain production in the northern hemisphere. What does that mean? That means no civilization. What does no civilization mean? It means no fuel at the filling station, no food at the grocery stores, and no water coming out of the municipal taps. Most people will assume that the government or the utility company will get the water back on soon. So when the water goes out in all the cities in the country or even in the world, one at a time, when the water just starts blinking out, when it goes out, the water is no longer flowing through the taps in Tucson, Arizona, and then Omaha, Nebraska, and then Eugene, Oregon, and so forth. Most people are going to sit there and wait because this has happened before. So they think the water is going to come back on, and 4 days later, they're going to die from dehydration. And the people who don't die from dehydration are going to die from hunger because the food stops showing up at the grocery store. And we have come to depend almost exclusively on food at the grocery store for our own survival. Almost nobody grows their own food anymore, and certainly mm-hmm. not enough to feed themselves and their families and the people around them. So, yes, dehydration and starvation will be among the leading causes of mortality. I suspect another one for people who live in places like Belize or other places near the equator, near the water, is going to be lethal wet bulb temperatures. And what that means is you get up to 95 degrees Fahrenheit at 100% humidity, or a higher temperature and a lower humidity, and your organs fail. The organs in your body, quote, boil, and so you are unable to function adequately. Initial symptoms include poor judgment. People start acting like they're drunk because their organs are failing. And organ failure is not going to be a pretty way to go, but it's already taking lots of people from the planet. And that number is sure to ratchet up in the very near future. So, you know, if we add another degree or two Celsius, we're going to experience millions of deaths from lethal wet bulb temperatures. We're already experiencing millions of deaths every year directly attributable to climate change. And that number is certain to increase when we tack on dehydration and lethal wet bulb temperatures. There will be other ways as well. You know, people will get even less friendly with each other than they already are. So I suspect people will start acting with increased violence. And so, and that'll scale up, not just at the individual level where, you know, somebody's going to kill you for your last can of peaches, but also at the level of society. So we're going to see increased resources. All wars are resource wars. So we're going to see increased military activity, which is pretty hard to imagine given what's going on as a result of the United States military already. We're going to see more, just more of everything. So, again, I don't know your expiration date, and I don't know how you're going to die. I wish I did. I wish I knew that for me. I wish I knew it for you. But that would make me Nostradamus, not a scientist. So,
and I mean, you're saying these things coming from a very scientific background. You're not just like you thought these ideas up on your own. This is all based on real science, hard facts. I do know that when I was taking an environmental politics class and in my international relations class, they were saying how this temperature of 2.5 that McGivern talks about is an extremely conservative number that we're way past. I mean, there are
We've never had a human being on the planet 2.5°C above the 1750 baseline. So you talk about that as if that's going to happen, we'll all be fine. What about the precautionary principle? According to James Hansen, in a legal brief filed in summer of 2015, we've had humans on the planet only up to about 2 degrees Celsius above the 1750 baseline. You can't talk about 2°C as if it's safe. We're already seeing millions of people die every year from climate change at 1.6 degrees, even at 1 degree above the 1750 baseline. So if you want to talk about 2.5, you're talking about death maybe of everybody on the planet right there, because we've never had humans above 2. Probably we haven't had humans, habitat for humans, above 2 degrees, and that's why we haven't had humans on the planet at 2 degrees Celsius above baseline. What does 2.5 look like? What does 4 look like? What does 6 look like? I don't know the temperature at which we become extinct, but I suspect we're a lot closer than most people think. And my perspective is greatly influenced by the fact that I'm a conservation biologist. So throughout my professional career, I studied speciation, extinction, and habitat. And so extending those notions to humans instead of just other plants and animals on the planet makes a lot of sense to me. You know, at one time there were a handful of Homo species walking around Africa at the same time. A handful of different species of the genus Homo walking around at the same time. And now there's one on the planet. To think that we will not go the way of the other species of our genus is pure hubris.
That's an interesting thought, that this is just the culmination of our evolution, that this is just the way it is. I mean, we have sort of created this whole environment. Wow.
99% of the species to ever occupy the planet are now extinct. Think about that for a minute. 99%. And we think we're so special that we can't ever go extinct, even though our closest relatives, a handful of our closest relatives in the same genus of us, as us, have already gone extinct? Why would we even think that? That's surreal.
It's definitely surreal, and it's interesting to have this conversation about it being so short, and to really kind of pay attention to the oncoming, you know, to when I asked you earlier, you know, how are we going to see this come about? Well, this is how it's going to come about, is that I guess our safety nets are just going to start not being so safe anymore. They're not going to be as reliable. That's when, as we see it all breaking down, that's when we know it's happening. Right now, we're just watching the animals die.
Right. Just the animals. But we're animals too, remember.
Right. And we're dropping off like flies too. Cancer is the number one killer of children in America. So, I mean, that to me is an outrage.
Who would have thought that? 40 years ago, remember, we were 10 years away from curing all forms of cancer. And here we are 40 years later, and it's the leading cause of human mortality for children in the richest country in the history of the planet.
Exactly.
I mean, I was promised flying cars by this time. Kid, we're going to have flying cars by now. We don't. Not only do we not have flying cars, but we have sources of mortality that we couldn't even imagine 45 years ago.
That's true.
So, of course, life is short. Of course, there are consequences for crapping in your own nest for the last 250 years. Of course there are consequences. To think that they're not, to think that we are so special, so removed from the earth we inhabit, is, again, just ridiculous. It lacks humility. It assumes that we are gods of some kind, divorced from reality.
I'm grateful for your message, because it really brings it home of how really urgent it is to make the right choices and to live the life that you want to live. You know, live with integrity and live with honor every day. And that's the only way that we're going to actually, I mean, however we end up or however long we have to live, if you live with the idea that we don't have that long to live and you live with integrity, you'll have a full life.
Yes. And what could be better than that? Even if your full life transpires over a span of 25 years, to have a full life, instead of having an empty, shallow, superficial life and dying at the age of 100. I'll take that full life that ends at 20 anytime. And it's too late for me to do that. But I'll take the full life that ends at 57 anytime.
Yes, exactly. Well, look, I do want to remind people to go to your website, GuyMcPherson.com. Check out the coming events. On March 16th through 18th, as we said, he's going to have a workshop in Belize. March 22nd and April 26th at the East Bay Sierra Club dinner, details forthcoming. And the SOAK event 2018, May 25th through the 29th, near Portland, Oregon, you're going to be there. So people can come and experience this and speak with you personally about these things. So I really appreciate you joining us, Guy. And I hope in like 6 to 8 weeks you can come back. I do want to keep putting this drum back in people's ears so that they can acclimate themselves to the reality.
I'm more than willing. I very much appreciate the opportunity to chat with you today, Lonnie. The pleasure is all mine.
Well, I really appreciate it, because this is the thing. When I say put your courage feet on, this is what I mean. We are facing some pretty big obstacles that may not be surmountable, but we can live with joy. We can live with happiness. We don't have to participate in the system that's meant to drive us to our mental demise, you know. So I really appreciate it. Thank you for joining us, you guys. I really encourage you to take some action, whatever that is in your own life. Put your courage feet on, and we'll talk with you guys soon. Thanks, Guy.